It is Monday, September the 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. It's very good to have you with us. Coming up, speaking Spanish and holding the people close to him, Pope Francis visits Cuba.
Here is someone who the people of Cuba would say is like one of us. And that gives him an entree. From there, of course, he's able to direct his message and the content of the message to people and invite them to respond.
Also ahead, resolving Burkina Faso's coup, plus making music at New York's Brill Building. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Pope Francis is on a historic 10-day trip, visiting Cuba first and then the United States. On Sunday, he celebrated Mass in Havana, warning Cubans of the dangers of ideology. He later met with former President Fidel Castro and the current Cuban President, Raul Castro. International Edition's Victor Beatty asked Father Brian Lucas, General Secretary of the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference, about the significance of the Pope's meetings with the Castros.
I think what we're seeing here is a move towards reconciliation. There was obviously many, many years of extraordinary hostility, not only between, for example, the Cuban regime and the United States of America, but enormous tensions within Cuba itself as the dictatorship had its impact on the people. What Pope Francis is doing is speaking to the people of Cuba and inviting them to a reconciliation among the different factions within the community. And, of course, we're familiar now with the role that he played in bringing about a greater rapprochement between Cuba and the United States.
How important are his Argentinian roots to his outreach to Latin America, specifically Cuba?
I think the fact that he can speak the language, the fact that he is part of the culture of Central and Southern America, gives him a credibility to begin with. Here is someone who the people of Cuba would say is like one of us. And that gives him an entree. From there, of course, he's able to direct his message and the content of the message to people and invite them to respond.
Francis, of course, the third pope to visit Cuba. Why is Cuba so important?
I think Cuba represents, of course, a regime of the past that was one of oppression and dictatorship. Cuba has its proper role in that part of the world in its relationship both to countries of South America, but also now with the opportunity for some peacemaking with the United States.
How vibrant is the Catholic Church in Cuba? From what I understand, 10% or less of Cubans identify themselves as Roman Catholics.
I think Cuba has, of course, been victim of oppression and dictatorship and an atheistic worldview. So perhaps three generations almost have been lost to a traditional Catholic faith. The remnant is there. The remnant is enthusiastic and vibrant, and we've seen that with the images here in Australia where I'm speaking from. We've seen the television images, and just only a short while ago I was able to see, thanks to the wonderful benefits of the internet, the Pope addressing the young people in Havana. And there was certainly an enthusiasm there and an openness. People are searching. They might regard themselves as secularist and atheistic, but people always ask those fundamental questions. What is my life about? Where do I come from? What is my destiny? And the Pope is offering them a way of living that picks up on the gospel message and the promise of Christ, of the fullness of life.
Of course, the Pope visits the United States in just a couple of days. Latest poll says 7 of 10 Americans have a favorable impression of Pope Francis, though they have a less positive view of the Catholic Church as a whole. What do you make of that?
I think that's not unexpected. People tend these days not to have favorable impressions of institutions because their impressions are largely formed by the media messages. It's the same in the United States as it is in Australia, in most Western countries, where the media tends to be, by its nature, anti-institutional. It tends to favour individualism because individualism is what feeds consumerism, and consumerism is what it is that is the lifeblood of advertising in secular media. So you can see the pattern that's there. But the personality of Pope Francis is vitally interesting for people. They see here someone who is different, someone who is not speaking in the idiom of past popes, whose simple gestures, going right back to when he was first elected and he walked into the hostel to pay his own account, that these sorts of images are fixed in people's minds, and so they have a favourable impression that here is someone who has something worthwhile to say. When we move then to the next step, of course, and we look at the content of what he says, for example, his most recent encyclical, Laudato Si, that's challenging because he's saying to a society such as the United States of America, well, capitalism is good, capitalism can only go so far, but there are other values that are important. And, of course, that challenges the absoluteness of the free market. It challenges the absoluteness of individualism and what is sometimes misrepresented as freedom. And that's why people are sometimes a little cautious about what the content of his message might be.
That is Father Brian Lucas. He is General Secretary of the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference, and he was speaking with my colleague Victor Beattie. While in the United States, Pope Francis will have a private meeting at the White House with President Obama. He'll give some speeches, one before a joint session of the U.S. Congress, another before the United Nations. He'll also appear before the Vatican-sponsored World Meeting of Families. That will be in the city of Philadelphia. And now it's time to catch up with International Edition's G. Abby Lee, who's here to talk about what's being said on Twitter about the Pope's visit to Cuba. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Let's begin with what Pope Francis himself tweeted about his visit to Cuba and the U.S. this month. Here's his latest tweet. I ask you to join me in praying for my trip to Cuba and the United States. I need your prayers. That tweet has been retweeted more than 11,000 times and marked as a favorite almost 30,000 times. Pope Francis on Twitter at Pontifex.
Gee, what are some of the hashtags related to the Pope's visit?
More than 6,000 tweets use the hashtag Pope Francis in the last 24 hours. A more specific hashtag, hashtag Pope in Cuba, was used in 3,000 tweets, and hashtag in U.S. was used in 2,400 tweets in the last 24 hours. Using the hashtag Pope in Cuba, I found John Williams' account, who is the managing editor for international affairs at ABC News. Williams is on Twitter at WilliamsJohn.
And what did he tweet?
He was tweeting a lot about the Pope's visit Sunday, but one tweet that got a lot of attention is about how Pope Francis got out of his car to join the crowd on his way to delivering Mass at the Revolution Square in Havana. He included a picture of Pope Francis getting out of the car and hashtag Pope in Cuba. Another tweet reads like this. Two revolutionaries together, Francis meets hashtag Fidel, photo taken by hashtag Castro's son Alex, hashtag Pope in Cuba, hashtag Pope. In the photo, the former Prime Minister and President of Cuba, Fidel Castro, is wearing a blue sports jacket while the Pope is dressed in his white gown. Steve, there are a lot of critical comments on the photo, by the way, with one person replying that Castro's hands are soaked in blood and another person tweeting it's a photo of God's representative and the representative of Satan. Steve?
And many thanks to you, G. That is International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And you can also follow International Edition on Twitter if you'd like. We're at VOA underscore IE. Also making news, migrants fleeing war and poverty in Northern Europe on Sunday called for Slovenia to open its border with Croatia. VOA's Daniel Scharf reporting now from a town on Croatia's border with Slovenia.
Migrants from the Middle East and Africa march in protest, demanding Slovenia allow them to cross over from neighboring Croatia.
The other borders are pleasant and easy. Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, only the Slovenian border is a problem.
Many escaped war and poverty, traveling for weeks, only to find their path to a better European life being blocked.
We demand not to die, for protection against terrorism and humiliation and accountability.
Croatia first welcomed the migrants, but quickly overwhelmed, sent thousands back to Hungary, which in turn sent them on to Austria. Those remaining on the border with Slovenia are being treated well and express their thanks to a local official.
Yes, food, sleeping, water. That is us, Harmonica's municipal, not government, municipal.
Many traveled from Serbia after Hungary blocked the border, and they may have to return that way. The Croatian government built a temporary settlement on the Serbia border to register refugees, indicating thousands more are expected.
As you can hear behind me, there's a great deal of agitation and excitement. People are expecting or hoping that buses will be coming soon to take them across the border into Slovenia. Whether or not they're actually going to come is not clear. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, on the Croatia-Slovenia border.
It's a rare experience that we have International Edition's Michael Lippin in the studio with us, especially to talk about his vacation. But he went on vacation in a very interesting part of the world, just to been in Israel.
Yeah, I was in Israel for about a week and a half, and I just got back to D.C. yesterday on Saturday.
You'd have to live in a cave in some isolated place not to be aware that the Middle East is a hotbed of news.
Never a dull moment in Israel, for sure.
We've heard a lot about refugees and migrants out of the Middle East ending up in Europe or elsewhere. And what are Israelis hearing in the news about what's happening?
Well, Israelis are very aware that Europe is being flooded with migrants, many of them refugees from the Middle East, from North Africa. And it's a big part of the news cycle, even in Israel. But Israel itself has not taken in any of these people, unlike Europe. Israel has had its own migrant problem for years now. There are tens of thousands of migrants in Israel from Africa, from Sudan, from Eritrea. Tens of thousands of them are in Israel, some of them in camps, many of them living in South Tel Aviv, the main financial center of Israel. And it's a problem for Israelis. Some Israelis are sympathetic to them and help them in various humanitarian ways, providing them with care, advocating for their rights. But I think the majority of Israelis are not very happy that they're there. The Israeli government in recent years built a big fence along the border with Egypt, and that almost brought the flow of these migrants from Africa to a halt. So from Israel's perspective, there is a migrant problem that they're facing themselves that they're still trying to work out. They want the Israeli government, as has for a long time, wanted to find a way to get these tens of thousands of Africans in the country to leave, to maybe even deport them. But the problem is Israel doesn't have relations with Sudan and Eritrea, and there are human rights concerns about sending people back against their will. So for that reason, under international norms, they can't just, you know, put them on a plane and send them to Sudan and Eritrea. They have to find other ways, maybe even other African countries, to take them. So for the time being, those tens of thousands of African migrants remain in Israel.
You know, I know, Michael, that Israel, having been there and watched television, it's not a lot different than other countries where there is, free television, that the politics doesn't make the news. In the United States, of course, we're in a political season now, very early in it, but it still dominates the news here. And I've noticed there it does as well. One thing that you have in Israel that we don't have in the United States, but other countries experience, are governments that are run by multiple parties, a coalition.
That's right.
Of people get together. So what was the political news in Israel while you were there?
Well, in Israel, you have a government that is formed by a variety of parties. I think they're about half a dozen. And they need, in order for the government to function, they need at least 61 seats out of the 120-seat member Knesset, or Israeli parliament. The current Israeli government is led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who leads the right-wing nationalist Likud party. He's been in office for quite a while. He just won his third consecutive election earlier this year. But this time, the Israeli government has a very, very narrow majority. It's actually 61 seats out of 120. So it's the absolute minimum that they could have to function. Now, the key test of this coalition will come in another month and a half, when the Israeli parliament has to pass a budget. If Netanyahu can get that budget through the various votes in the Knesset and have it succeed, then his government probably will survive for a while longer.
Yeah, interesting. And I'm sure you'll be tweeting about it when it happens.
I'll try to.
Michael Lippin is a social media guru. Your Twitter address is...
If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Michael_Lippin. That's spelled L-I-P-I-N.
Right. And you're also very active in putting together the International Edition Twitter account.
I do monitor that Twitter account, and I post tweets quite often. It's at @VOA_IE, so please go there and follow us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
International Edition's Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America. Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition, and now the Africa beat in the way of news. West African mediators from the regional group ECOWAS trying to end the political crisis in Burkina Faso Sunday announced a draft, unsigned agreement aimed at restoring civilian rule following last week's military coup that overthrew a transitional administration. The hotel in the capital, Ouagadougou, where the negotiations were being held, was the target of protests by pro-coup demonstrators and members of the Presidential Guard. Anti-coup protests continued for a fourth day on Sunday. Demonstrators erected barricades across the city. Associated violence has left at least 10 dead and 100 others wounded. The draft proposal announced by ECOWAS chairman and Senegalese President Macky Sall Sunday would restore civilian authority but offer amnesty to the coup leaders. Presidential and parliamentary elections set for October the 11th would be held sometime before November the 22nd. Candidates loyal to former President Blaise Compaoré, who was excluded from the October polls, would not be allowed to run, a key element prompting Wednesday's coup. Compaoré ruled Burkina Faso for 27 years before he was toppled by a popular uprising last year when he tried to change the constitution to extend his presidency. The plan would be submitted now to the African Union summit that'll be tomorrow for their approval. Two young suicide bombers Sunday killed at least three other people in what appeared to be the latest cross-border attacks by Nigeria's Boko Haram Islamist militant group. The attack in the northern town of Mora occurred just a few kilometers from Boko Haram's strongholds in northeastern Nigeria. It marked the third time since the start of September that the area had been hit by double suicide blast. Seven people were killed in a strike in Kolafata back on September the 13th, you'll remember. As many as 40 people there were thought to have died in a bombing out also on September the 3rd in Karawa. Since July, about 100 people have died in suicide attacks in the extreme northern part of Cameroon, which is a major contributor to an 8,700-strong Nigerian-led regional force expected to start operations against Boko Haram this year. Three blasts struck Maiduguri, the state capital of Nigeria's northeastern Borno state, late Sunday, with one report indicating at least eight people were killed there. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but Boko Haram is suspected. Nigerian military spokesman said it signifies the high level of desperation on the part of the Boko Haram terrorist. And Tanzania's main opposition party, Kadima, says it will file a lawsuit Monday against the ruling Kamakan Mapinduzi, that's the CCM, and its presidential candidate, John Magufuli, for accusing them of stealing the party's symbols, their logo and manifesto in a violation of the country's Copyright Election Act, as well as local and international intellectual property rights. John Malia, Kadima's head of legal and electoral activities, told VOA Sunday the slogan Movement for Change, or M4C, is registered, patented, and trademarked by the opposition.
CCM has been illegally and unlawfully grabbed our message, our signs, contrary to the provisions of the law. Now, Chadema has decided to take Magufuli, CCM candidates, and CCM as a party to the court on Monday.
Mahia says it appears the ruling party aims to confuse prospective voters because of the crowds the opposition party campaigns have been attracting ahead of the election. Supporters of the CCM have rejected the accusations as being without merit, saying they will continue to embrace the party's Magufuli for Change, the 4MC slogan. They vowed to meet the opposition party in court, contending that the ruling party has every right to use the word change in its campaign. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
While it may not taste as good as other sports drinks, British researchers say that they have found that drinking beet juice supplemented with nitrates helps athletes get through long sporting events by improving their running performance and boosting their decision-making abilities. The researchers from Exeter University recruited 16 male rugby, hockey, or football players as their test subjects. The athletes were all given about 140 milliliters, a little over a half a glass, of a high nitrate beet juice to drink every day for a week. At the end of the week, sportsmen were given physical and cognitive tests. The Exeter researchers said they saw an improvement in the athletes' running and decision-making abilities after drinking the nitrate-enhanced beet juice. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for being with us.
Hear the neon lights up bright on Broadway. I hear the dreams come true there every day.
The Brill Building is on Broadway. It's been home to dozens of music companies where songwriters such as Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil wrote hits like On Broadway for the R&B girls group The Cookies. The song was later covered by greats such as George Benson, for whom it was a chart topper. And then there was this super hit. Little Eva singing The Locomotion, written by the husband and wife team of Jerry Goffin and Carol King. They wrote the song in their offices at the Brill Building. Locomotion was not only a big hit for Little Eva, Grand Funk Railroad, and Kylie Minogue also went to the top of the charts with the song in the 1970s and 80s. And guess who this is?
Only true in fairy tales, and for someone else, but not for me. Our love was out to get me. That's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer.
That's The Monkee singing Neil Diamond's I'm a Believer, written at the Brill Building early on in Diamond's career.
I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried.
Remember this song? A singles hit and an Academy Award winner for the film Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Raindrops are falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun.
Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head was written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David at the Brill Building and sung by B.J. Thomas.
Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. But there's one thing
so-called Brill Building sound includes the mainstream of American popular songs from gospel to rhythm and blues, pop, country, and rock and roll. The Brill Building still stands in the heart of New York's Theater District, where it was built in 1931.
But that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. Crying's not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free. Nothing's worrying me.
Oh, yeah. Must have been a lot of fun being a singer-songwriter at the Brill Building in New York. I've been through that building. It's an amazing spot. You should check it out sometimes. One other story for you. The top award of the 40th annual Toronto International Film Festival on Sunday went to Lenny Abramson's movie Room. It's an emotional tale of a captive mother and her five-year-old son. One of my colleagues saw the trailer. He said, don't bother. But anyway, it won the top honors there. It was quite an event. Runner-up went to Tom McCarthy's Spotlight. It's a newspaper story about Michael Keaton and Mark Ruffalo starring in it, about the Boston Globe investigation of sexual abuse by Catholic priest. Well, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since the separation of South Sudan in July 2011, the Republic of Sudan's economy has spiraled downward. The loss of 75% of its oil revenue, along with ongoing conflict in parts of the country, particularly the Darfur, Blue Nile, and Kordofan regions, has caused massive displacement of the population and, as a result, a disruption of food production. This means that large segments of the population are going to bed hungry every night. Today, some 4 million Sudanese people are in desperate need of food assistance. In a bid to head off a potential food insecurity in Sudan, the United Nations World Food Programme, or WFP, aims to deliver food and nutrition to around 2.3 million people. Another 715,000 will receive food in payment for helping to create or restore community infrastructure, or to help increase the incomes of their fellow citizens by providing support and skills. The United States is assisting the WFP wherever possible. Through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the United States government is contributing $86 million in food assistance to the WFP to be used for the benefit of those in need of assistance in Sudan's Darfur, North Kordofan, and West Kordofan states. Of the $86 million donated, $75 million will purchase about 69,000 metric tons of U.S. food. The remaining $11 million will come in the form of food vouchers, allowing voucher recipients to make their own choices from a variety of food items. This funding will also include enough cash for WFP to purchase more than 103 metric tons of locally produced specialized nutrition products to prevent and treat malnutrition in children under age 5. This most recent contribution brings the total U.S. government food assistance for Sudan to $170 million this year. The American people, this time working through WFP, remain committed to helping vulnerable Sudanese, said U.S. Chargé d'Affaires Ambassador Jerry Lanier. We hope that current conflict ceases soon, so there will no longer be need for food assistance in Sudan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
for.